and I hope everyone is doing. Some more people have joined, so I'm going to put the link in the chat again for the source sheet. Welcome to Icons of Jewish Morocco. Those who were on a minute ago or 2 minutes ago already saw my Zoom is doing strange things in terms of my screen every once in a while. Oh, there it goes again. My video is jumping. I have a couple of thoughts about what might be causing it. I know it's a distraction, but I think I have to live with it for this hour. So whenever I notice it, I'll just turn off video and turn it back on, and then we'll be good for another 30 seconds. I'm going to mute everybody by default because I'm getting background noise. Okay. So, now it's doing it again. I don't know. I may just live with it. I don't know. We'll see. In any case, like with our previous series, I am recording audio and I plan to upload it afterwards and send out a sheet with a link so that everybody is able to download audio either for reviewing classes or using it in case you have to miss a session. So if you registered, you will be on the email list in order to get the audios afterwards. In the event that you have not registered, please do go to torontotorah.com/Wednesday, and that way you'll be able to register. Our plan for the series is to begin with the 11th century. We'll be talking about Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. Then we're going to jump to 17th, 18th centuries, Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar. I will discuss some of the history in between. We'll see. And then to move to the 19th and 20th centuries, and that's really, to me, the most fascinating part of the series, Baba Sali and Rabbi Shalom Mashash. Not that the earlier parts are not fascinating, they are. However, I've talked about the earlier parts in other classes at other times, whether with this group or elsewhere, and I've never really discussed modern Morocco. So I'm looking forward to getting a chance to do that. But that's more or less where we're going with it. Everybody good? Now, I know that we have a few people here who have good knowledge of Morocco, whether from tours or from family history, and I welcome your comments at different times on this, to help out. Those who just got on the video jumping, don't worry about it. It's just my screen for today. And it looks like we're just going to have to deal with it. So, there it goes. Back on for now. Okay. So I began, if you take a look at the source sheet, with the epitaph that appears on the stone for Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi's grave. His grave is not in Morocco. His grave is in Lucena, in Spain. I might be mispronouncing Lucena. I don't know if anybody knows that I'm mispronouncing it or that I'm getting it right. Okay, then Lucena it is. That's where he's buried in Spain. We'll talk about why. But his epitaph is written by none other than Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is known for authoring what book? He authored more than one thing, but he's best known for writing the Kuzari, the great work of Jewish philosophy. He was a student of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. He was also a great poet. His most famous poem is probably Tzion Halo Tishali, a poem about Tzion that has been read on Tisha B'Av mornings for centuries and centuries. Take a look at what he wrote. This is my translation of it, obviously. Mountains on the day of Sinai quaked for you, for the angels of God encountered you. He's describing Rabbi Alfasi. He's saying, on the day that the Torah was given at Sinai, the mountains quaked because of this student of Torah, Rabbi Alfasi. The angels of God encountered him. They wrote the Torah on the walls of your heart. I put in the parentheses tablets because the word in Hebrew is luchot, like the tablets at Sinai. The most desirable of crowns they set upon you. The wise could not marshal the strength to stand if not for the wisdoms they learned from you. That image that he's creating here. The Rabbi Halevi is, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is creating here in describing Rabbi Alfasi, is borrowing from Midrash. There are all sorts of Midrashim that the rabbis taught regarding the day the Torah was given. And they described, based on verses in Tanakh, the mountains quaking when the Torah was given, the angels being there at the presentation of the Torah and protesting the presentation of the Torah. And what he's saying is that these mountains that are quaking because of Rabbi Alfasi. The angels are not encountering Moshe, they're not encountering Moses, they're encountering Rabbi Alfasi. The Torah is written on the walls of Rabbi Alfasi's heart. The crowns that are given to the Jews at Sinai, as described in the Torah, are on Rabbi Alfasi's head. The Torah is being given to Rabbi Alfasi. That's what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is saying. He's saying that you are the one who received the Torah at Sinai, and you are the one who transmitted it. So all of those who are wise could not have the strength to stand if not for what you, Rabbi Alfasi, taught them. You follow? That's what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is saying at the grave of Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. And so what I want to do in our hour is, first of all, I'm going to want to talk about the Moroccan community in Fez, where he flourished, and get some understanding of the Jews there. But then I want to know, who was this great scholar, and what was his impact such that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would write this about him on his headstone? Clear? Okay. So, you know that we do different kinds of classes, and sometimes our classes are philosophy, and sometimes our classes are about Tanakh, and then there's a lot of discussion. When we do Jewish history, there tends to be more monologuing on my part, unfortunately. So, you know, feel free to interrupt at various times, especially if you have experience of Morocco that might help us to understand what we're learning. Questions and comments so far, other than to comment on the weird video that's still, you know, doing its thing. Oh, I gotta mute everybody. I'm hearing something. Okay, so let's go into Dahlia. You were gonna say? You're muted. Still muted.
Sorry, what was the name of the city you were going to talk about?
Oh, the city in Morocco where he lives is Fez.
Spell it?
I'm going to write it in the chat.
It's F-E-Z.
Yes, F-E-Z.
F-E-Z.
Oh, it's not the
Cantonese.
And if you've been there, it was a big center of Judaism.
Yes, and
I mean,
that's
I've been there.
Yeah, that's what we're going to, that is, a big part of the conversation we're going to have. So if you take a look on your sheet, you see that in source number 2, I gave you a map. I gave you the website where you can find this map. If you printed that in black and white, it's not as good as in color. So they definitely want to look at the original file in in color to really appreciate it. What you're seeing there is the northwest corner of Africa. And Morocco, of course, is the northwest corner of Africa, as you can see there. On mine, I printed it out in black and white. And the boundaries between the land and the water don't look so good on the black and white. Nonetheless, working with it, there's a lot that we have to highlight about Morocco for which this map is going to be important. First of all, classically, historically, the native residents of this Northwest Africa area were tribes called the Berbers. Sometimes you also see the name Amazigh, which is a reference to the languages that are spoken in that region. They're not just in Morocco. It's basically the western part of the southern coast of the Mediterranean. so that if you're looking at a map today of North Africa and you're going from west to east, it's Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, right? Until you get to Egypt, basically. They're not, the Berbers are not in Egypt. But the Berbers occupy this area along the southern coast of the Mediterranean. Now, the area of Morocco in particular was isolated from the major empires of the day, largely because of topography. However, it was really desirable because of geography. In terms of the topography, if you look at the map, you could see it, especially if you look at it in color. You're dealing with, first of all, and most obviously, water on your west, the Atlantic Ocean, and water to the north, that's the Mediterranean Sea. And then if you look east and south, you see mountain ranges. The Middle Atlas, the High Atlas, the Anti-Atlas Mountains, and then further to the south is the Sahara Desert. So, in terms of topography, you have mountains that are blocking you off other than your coasts. You also have the challenge of trying to cross the Sahara Desert in the south, but it's very desirable geographically. Why, what is it that would appeal to somebody? Why would somebody want to take control of this area that becomes Morocco? What's the appeal?
The coast. The water.
The coast, right? You have ports. You have a port on the Atlantic. You have a port on the Mediterranean. That's an important part. What else? You also have fertile land. This is great land on the Atlantic coast. Your climate is a Mediterranean climate. It's not an African climate. So this is a very appealing place for people. Not to mention, you had certain trade routes that crossed the Sahara. If you control Morocco, you control access to the Sahara Desert. And then, as Leah notes in the chat, gateway to Europe across the Straits of Gibraltar. That would be a major factor as well. So for all of these reasons, it's a very desirable place, but it's kind of hard to get access to it. So it isn't part of the various empires we think about during this period. It's not part of the African kingdoms to the south and east. It's not part of the Byzantine and Ottoman empires. It's not part of Christian Europe. They face invasions periodically. That's basically what happens to the Moroccans. Okay, questions and comments on that? Janine, you were going to say something? No? Okay.
Just one thing.
Yeah, Rose.
If you look at the Berbers as people, they actually look in quite different to the other Arab nations. They have a very much more square face. They've got a lighter skin. They don't look like the more indigenous people, or
right. I mean, Berbers are not right. Berbers are not. They're not ethnically Arab.
They're not exactly. No.
That's very true.
Yeah.
So the Berbers are there for a very, very long time, until the Roman Empire comes along, and Rome conquers Morocco in 146 before the Common Era. Until today, you can see Roman ruins from when the Romans occupied it. Now, the Roman presence in Morocco fades along with the Roman Empire, eventually. Then you get the Vandals. The Vandals are a Germanic tribe, and they invade coming south from Spain in 429 of the Common Era. They conquer North Africa. However, they get conquered by the Byzantines in 534. Don't worry about the years. You're not going to get tested on it. But I'm trying to just orient us. So the Byzantines, Justinian, conquer them in the year 534 of the Common Era. And then Islam comes sweeping through in the 7th century. The Muslim Arabs spread west. The Umayyad Caliphate controls all of North Africa and invades Europe, and they control the Berber tribes who live in Western North Africa. So they go from being Roman to being under the Vandals to being under the Byzantines to being under the Muslims. The Berbers are still the native population. They're just, they just become dominated by others. And when the Berbers throw off the Umayyads in the 8th century, they take control back for themselves, but they are now Muslim. And from then on, Morocco is a Muslim country. Now, I don't want to go into all the ins and outs of the different dynasties, the Abbasids, the Fatimids. It's not relevant for our discussion. But in the period that we're going to focus on today, when Rav Yitzchak Alfasi comes to Morocco, which is going to be in the 11th century, the Almoravids are in charge. It's the Almoravid dynasty. Some of you were in a class I taught at Beth Tikva in, I think it was 2019, where we talked about the Almohads. And in order to talk about the Almohads, we also had to talk about the Almoravids. So we learned a little bit about them then. Their story begins in the 1030s. There was a Berber leader named Yahya ibn Ibrahim who brought in a Muslim religious teacher, Ibn Yasin, to learn about Islam. And after Ibn Ibrahim died, this fellow Ibn Yasin took over. He allied himself with another tribe, and they promoted an ideal of developing pure Islam and going to war against Muslims who don't believe what they believe, to try to create a religious caliphate. And that motivation was a religious motivation as well as an economic motivation. And they became the Almoravids. The Almoravids presented themselves as severe adherents of Islam. The name Almoravid may come from the term ribat for a school, or Ravat, a tie to God. There are different explanations, but it's a religious identity. And they said that the rulers we replaced were materialistic, they were self-serving. We, on the other hand, are going to be pure in our Islam. And the fortunes of Jews and Christians living under the Almoravids really depend on who is leading them at the time. There were times when Jews were banned from living in the capital of Morocco at that time, which was Marrakesh. There were times when Jews were attacked. Jews were forced to wear garb that marked them as dhimmi, these protected minorities under Islam, right? You remember the class that we had on the Jewish badge? We pointed out that having to wear particular clothing is not a Christian invention. It starts with Islam. Jews really were at the mercy of, such as it was, the Muslim leaders of the Almoravid dynasty. Clear? That's just basic background on the population of Morocco from ancient times coming into the 11th century. Look at all that we learned. It's only 1018. So,
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Where was Carthage? Wasn't that there?
So Carthage is Tunisia, a little further east.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to talk about them in a little bit because it's going to sort of intersect somewhat in terms of the Jews of Morocco. But yeah, Carthage is a little bit to the east. So the Jews of Morocco, where did the Jews of Morocco come from? Well, the Jewish community in Morocco claims that they arrived, some of them, with the destruction of the first temple, which is somewhere around 5th, 6th century before the Common Era, depending on whose chronology you adopt. Certainly, there are Jews who arrive with the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans in the 1st century Common Era. We know that there are Hebrew headstones from Roman times in Morocco. There is, according to something I found online, I didn't actually see it myself, I haven't been there, an ancient synagogue destroyed in the 3rd century of the Common Era. So you know that Jews have some kind of culture, some kind of civilization going in Morocco at that point. More of them came from Spain in the 7th century Common Era. The Visigoths spread throughout what would ultimately become Spain at that point, and Jews fled south to Morocco. And there's Jewish travel along the North African coast throughout this period from the 7th to the 10th centuries. So there is, there's quite a bit of Jewish life ebbing and flowing in Morocco at this time. Now, there are some who suggest that there were Berber tribes who actually converted to Judaism. This comes from a writer in the 14th century. His name was Ibn Khaldun, written in English K-H-A-L-D-U-N. That's usually the way that it's transliterated in English. So, based on his writing, there are those who suggest that there were Berber tribes that converted to Judaism before Islam came along. But it's really hard to know anything, and writers tend, in general, to be skeptical about this. Could be. But talking now about the 10th, 11th centuries, the period that we're looking at today. So the Jews of this time really have shifting fortunes under the Muslims, as I said regarding the Almoravids. There are thousands of Jews who are living in Morocco at that time. They are largely based in the city of Fez. And if you look at the map that I gave you on the source sheet, you can see that Fez is in northern Morocco near the Mediterranean coast. Everyone sees that? The city of Fez was founded in the year 808 of the Common Era. So Fez has already been around for some time by the time of the events that we're going to be learning about. Sometimes it was a good place to be a Jew. Other times it was horrible. In the year 1033, there was a massacre of more than 6,000 Jews. There was a battle between Berber tribes. The Zenata tribe was one of them. And the other one was, actually no, they were both Zenata tribes, I should say. The Zenata are fighting the Zenata, and the Jews are the ones who are suffering along the way. At this period, there is significant Jewish learning going on in Fez, but it's really hard to know the full extent. And this requires that I give a little bit more background on the Jewish world of this time. I gave you a reference on the sheet. I put it in as source number 4, but I'm going to mention it now. I have a class that I give on Thursday mornings. It's to a particular group. It's not one of those that's advertised. But the recordings are available. It's called Giants Of. That's what I call it. It's Giants of Jewish Law, Giants of Commentary to Tanakh, Giants of Commentary to the Talmud. That's the idea for it. It only began after the summer, so we've only had about 10, 11 sessions. But it's one of the things that I talk about in this series, the Giants Of series, is a period called the period of the Gaonim. I want to explain what that means. The Talmud is concluded, it's canonized, in the middle of the 6th century. And the Common Era, that's the Babylonian Talmud. At that stage, the Jewish world of the scholarly Jewish world is based in yeshivot, central academies where Torah is studied, that had been part of the Babylonian Empire. They're in what is today Iraq. One of them is called Sura. Another one is called Pumbedita. Another one is called Matamachsia. Pumbedita, the city of Pumbedita, is also known as Fallujah. If you think of Iraq today. So you have these central academies. After the Talmud is concluded, there's a period of a few generations where there's some redaction going on, and what emerges is a society that's built around the heads of the academies. And the head of the academy is called the Gaon. The central academies, as I mentioned, are in this area of Iraq. However, you do have yeshivot in Israel, and you have a yeshiva in what is called Kairouan. And that goes back to what Eti said. Kairouan is, as I understand it, Carthage. That's in Tunisia. So you do have a yeshiva there, and that yeshiva is important in its own right. But what I'm trying to get at is that the main scholarship that's going on in the Jewish world is in these yeshivot, is in these academies, and those who live in other communities may have local schools, but when they need to know something, they write away to the heads of these yeshivot, the gaonim, to ask them for counsel. That runs from the 7th century all the way to the beginning of the 11th century. Clear? We good? Okay. Fez has some learning going on. They have local schools. Occasionally, they have significant sages. So in the 10th century, as one example, there's somebody by the name of Dunash ibn Labrat. Dunash ibn Labrat was a grammarian, he was a poet, he was a scholar, and he lived in Fez until he moved to Spain. There was a scholar in Spain in Chazdai ibn Shafrut who was trying to assemble the leaders of Jewish learning in Spain. Spain was on the rise as the communities that were in Iraq were in decline. So when Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi arrives in Fez, which we're going to be talking about, he will become leader of the local school, the local yeshiva there. There were other notable figures there in his day. There was a Rabbi Zachariah ben Yehuda Agmati. There was a Rabbi Yehuda HaKohen ibn Shoshan. He was killed, this is after Rabbi Alfasi's time, he was in the 12th century. He was killed by the Almohads for refusing to convert to Islam. Maimonides would actually live in Morocco for some period of time. He left Spain, he went to Morocco, and then moved on to Israel, and then finally Egypt. There's actually a book, which I had a link for it on the sheet, but then I wanted to fit the sheet into one double-sided page, so I didn't include the link for it. But there's a book called Malchi Rabbanan, which collects the names and brief identities of sages from the past 2,000 years ago who lived in, the last 2,000 years, who lived in Morocco. You can get it on Hebrew books. Ricky, as I said in the beginning, it's just my video that's jumping. And that's what we're stuck with for today for reasons unknown. Okay. So that's just a little bit of background on the Jewish community, to go with the background we now have in general about Morocco, till we get to the 11th century, which is our focus for today. Questions, comments? We're good? Okay. So, this brings us to Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. So let's talk a little bit of biography. He was born in Algeria. Okay, so if you remember the North African coast, Morocco in the west, right? That's our starting point is Morocco. And then as you move east, your next land that you get to right after the mountains is Algeria. So he was born in a place called Kilat Hamad in Algeria in the year 1013. He studied in that yeshiva in Kairouan, Carthage, right? There you go, Eti, that's your reference for Carthage. He studied there in Tunisia under two sages, Rabbeinu Hananel, who wrote a commentary on the Talmud that is still used today, and Rabbeinu Nisim Gaon, who was the head of the yeshiva in Kairouan. However, in the year 1045, Rabbi Alfasi he wasn't known as Alfasi at that point. Alfasi is, you know, the one from Fez. But in the year 1045, due to persecution in Tunisia, he flees west to Fez. And they take him in, and he becomes head of the yeshiva there, and that's his name, Alfasi, Rabbi Yitzchak of Fez. He stays there for 43 years. In the year 1088, at the age of 75, his enemies make accusations to the royal court in Morocco, saying that he was disloyal, and he flees to Spain. He moves around a little bit in Spain. Eventually, he comes to Lucena, where he heads the local yeshiva. He teaches many great pupils, among them Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who we mentioned, right, the one who wrote that epitaph. Another one was a sage named Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Migash. Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Migash is the mentor of the father of Maimonides, of Maimon, in other words. So the chain of Jewish tradition goes Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Migash, Maimon, to Maimonides, to the Rambam. That's how it is transmitted. Interestingly, he appoints Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Migash instead of, I keep saying Yitzchak. There are a lot of Yitzchaks in this era, but he is not. He's Yosef. Rabbi Yosef Ibn Migash, he appoints him to replace him as head of the yeshiva. Take a look at source number 3. Zev Yavetz, a historian, wrote an article, The Era of Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi and Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. And in this article, which is available online on benyehuda.org, but this is my translation of it, his article is in Hebrew, he says, as much as he placed the son of his rival as his own son, because he was a lover of righteousness and a man of generosity, and that's a reference to a story we're going to come back to, in which Rabbi Alfasi takes care of the son of somebody who had been his bitter opponent. We'll talk about that. But as much as he took care of the son of his enemy, so he overpowered his love for his own son, his flesh and blood, because of his love for truth and justice. What does that mean? He had a wise son named Rabbi Yaakov, who was great in Torah. And yet he placed first before his son Rabbi Yaakov, his student Rabbi Yosef Ben Migash, because he saw that his student was very great, greater than his own son. And when his death neared, he placed his hands upon his student Rabbi Yosef and placed him on his seat, and he set him in his own place as the head of the communities of Lucena and all of Hispania. So he takes the student over his own son. And you know that there has always been in Judaism a sense that if you're worthy and your child is worthy, your child inherits a position from you. You see that in the monarchy. It doesn't always happen, and sometimes it happens and it shouldn't happen. And among Torah scholars, it certainly doesn't always happen. But it's still surprising to see it, that he has a son who apparently is great, and he says, no, my student is greater, and he appoints his student to replace him instead. He dies in Lucena in the year 1103, at the age of 90.
Rabbi, I think it's actually Lucena, because in Italian and in Spanish, the S is pronounced Ch.
So why didn't you say anything when I asked the half an hour ago?
No, because at first I had to look at the spelling. Sorry.
Okay.
Apologies.
No problem. Could be Lucena, which is just fine. I'm going to do Lucena for the second half of the class today, and one of the halves will be correct. And then when I get a chance, God willing, I will actually look it up and get a definitive answer as to whether it's Lucena or Lucena. Thank
Lucena
you.
Lucena in Italy or in
Spain? Spain.
Then it would be choice in Italy.
I don't understand what you just said. It's in Spain.
Then it's Lucena. If it's in Italy, it would be Lucena.
Okay. We're not spending more time on this, folks. I'm going to look it up and that'll be our answer, but our focus is when he's in Fez anyway. What happens afterwards, is not necessarily our focus until we get there. So, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi is best known for his magnum opus, Sefer HaHalachot, literally the Book of the Laws. This was a massive shift in the way that Jewish law was transmitted. Let's go back to the Talmud. The Talmud is not a code of law. You're not going to find in the Talmud chapter and verse, so to speak. I want to know the laws of prayer for the first day of the new month, for Rosh Chodesh. So I look up, here's a section that has it, and chapter 3, law number 4, is you're not going to find that in the Talmud. The Talmud is a record of debates and stories, and the debates themselves appear in different places in the Talmud. If you want to find a conclusion, you have to master a range of different passages that all discuss this, this particular issue, and then understand how to determine from those debates which view we follow, what the law actually is. And often it's not stated explicitly as to what the conclusion is in any of the places where the discussion happens. So people in the post-Talmudic period, if they want to know what the Jewish law is, they write a letter to the Gaon. Some of the Gaonim recorded particular works of law. If you go to that series that I have in source number 4, that I linked there, I discuss some of them. There's a work called She'ildot, there's a work called Halachot Gedolot, there's a Siddur from Rav Amram Gaon, but there's no full code of law. That won't come along until Maimonides in the 12th century. So Rabbi Alfasi does something which effectively is a bridge. It takes you from the time, from what they're doing in the period of the Gaonim, and gives you something that is much stronger. What he does is he goes through the Talmud, and he follows the debates of the Talmud, but he only records that which is followed in practice. So he only gives you that which is practically relevant. In a little bit, I'm going to share screen with you so that you could actually see what this looks like. I'm not ready to just yet. But he started doing this when he was just 17 years old. Okay, at the age of 17, he starts work on this. It incorporates not only the Babylonian Talmud, but the Jerusalem Talmud, which was concluded centuries before the Babylonian Talmud. It includes the teachings and rulings of the Gaonim, who we've talked about. It covers the practical segments of the Talmud, as opposed to the ones that, in the 11th century, were not being practiced because we didn't have a Beis HaMikdash, we didn't have a temple during that time. So it covers the sections of Jewish law that deal with the holidays, that deal with marriage and divorce, that deal with financial issues, that deal with blessings on food. He covers all of that, and he presents the law either explicitly or implicitly. And I want to give you examples so you understand what I'm saying. The examples are a little bit technical. Bear with me. An example of him saying something explicitly is found in source number 5. We know that on Rosh Hashanah we blow shofar, right? That sounds familiar? Okay, we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Very good. What happens if Rosh Hashanah is Shabbos? Then what do? We don't blow shofar, right? That is a rabbinic decree, saying even though you have a biblical mitzvah to blow shofar, don't do it, because we are concerned that people who don't know how to blow shofar are going to carry the shofar through a public area to go to a scholar who will teach them how to blow shofar, and carrying in a public area on Shabbat is a serious biblical prohibition. So therefore they said don't blow shofar on Shabbat. However, in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, where you had reason to assume that they knew how to blow shofar, they were allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, at the end of the temple period, instituted blowing shofar in a city called Yavne, which was where the high court convened. That's where the sages were based. And then you get a passage in the Talmud which discusses the possibility of blowing shofar in a Beit Din, in a rabbinical court. And that's where you get source number 5. Rabbi Alfasi brings the following passage from the Talmud regarding blowing shofar in a rabbinical court when Rosh Hashanah is Shabbos. Rav Huna said, and they blow shofar even on Shabbat with the rabbinical court. What is with the rabbinical court? What does that mean? This is all him quoting the Talmud. In front of the rabbinical court, as opposed to when it is not in front of the rabbinical court, when they would not blow shofar, meaning the rabbinical court has to be in session. It was also taught, Rabbi Chiya bar Gamda cited Rabbi Yossi ben Shaul, citing, Rabbi, we only blow shofar when the rabbinical court is in session. So if you have a rabbinical court, you are actually going to blow shofar on Shabbos. He quotes that from the Talmud. So take a look at source number six. Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, who lives in the end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th, records the following about Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. They said of Rav Alfas, Zichrono Levracha, blessed memory, that he blew shofar on Rosh Hashanah, which was on Shabbat. He did it in his rabbinical court. And so is indicated in his halachot. Look at his work of law, where he brought Rav Huna's statement and with the rabbinical court. And he only brings that which is practiced today. The fact that he quoted this is because he believed this should be practical. And he explained, wherever there's a rabbinical court, to me, not only the Sanhedrin, this great court that convened with 70 elders, but any superlative rabbinical court, the greatest in its generation. If you are the greatest court of your generation, then you would do it. And his students did not do this after him, but his students did not feel strong enough to do this. He did it. His students did not. So I saw the note. Somebody sent me a question in the chat directly. Why would the rabbinical court be in session on Rosh Hashanah? So the answer is they would not be hearing cases. It just means that the sages are actually there. They're officially present in, you know, together in the community. It's a good question. It doesn't actually mean that they are hearing cases that day. So I bring you this as an example of Rabbi Alfasi quoting a passage from the Talmud, which is a controversial passage, and the fact that he quotes it is because he believes that that, in fact, is the law. That's an example of him explicitly doing something. I'm going to give you an example of something implicit in sources 7 and 8. Source number 7 is a passage from the Talmud. Has to do with the issue of smicha. Smicha can mean different things. In this case, what it means is ordination to give rulings in Jewish law. So take a look here. The Talmud quotes you a passage from the book of Proverbs, Mishlei. Some of you are in my Tuesday afternoon class where we started learning Mishlei yesterday afternoon. What does Proverbs chapter 7 mean when it says, "For she has killed many corpses, ki atzumim kol harugeha." She has killed many corpses. What in the world does that mean? And the rest of the sentence is, and mighty are all she has killed. What in the world are you talking about? What does that mean? So the first half of the sentence, she has killed many corpses, refers to a student who has not reached the level of issuing halachic rulings, and he issues halachic rulings anyway. If somebody is not yet at the age where, or the level, I should say, the level where they can give answers to Jewish law, and yet they do it, they're going to suffer a bad end. They shouldn't do it prematurely. What about the second half of the sentence, and mighty are all she has killed? What is that talking about? That's a student who has reached the level of issuing halachic. He does not issue halachic rulings. That's if you are eligible, and you don't do it. Don't do it prematurely. But on the other hand, don't refuse to do it once you can. Until what age? So what is the age? How do you know when you are at the level? Says the Talmud, 40 years old. To which they ask, but wait a minute, the sage Rava issued halachic rulings before he turned 40. How did he do that? Yeah, because there was nobody else. He was more worthy than anybody else that he could do it. But you're not supposed to do it until the age of 40. That's the passage in the Talmud in source number 7. Clear? I have a biblical verse from Proverbs that talks about people being killed, right? And she has killed many corpses, mighty all she has killed. It has to do with those who either issue legal rulings when they shouldn't, or those who do not issue legal rulings when they are really eligible. Along comes Rabbi Alfasi in source number 8, and he doesn't quote the entire passage. He only quotes part of it. What does Proverbs chapter 7, sentence 26 mean when it says, "For she has killed many corpses"? This is a student who has not reached the level of issuing halachic rulings, and he issues halachic rulings. And mighty are all she has killed. This is a student who has reached the level of issuing halachic rulings, and he does not issue halachic rulings. He quotes that entire piece. Until what age? 40 years. Until the age of 40. And he stops the passage at that point. That's where he halts. He only applies the limitation of 40 years to the second half of the passage. That's why he omits what happens with Rava. In other words, go back to source number 7, and I said this was going to be a little technical. In source number 7, there were two halves. One is, don't issue rulings too early, and the other one, don't stall issuing rulings. And then it gives us the age of 40. I see the notes in the chat. I'll answer you. And then it gives the age of 40 as the marker. But I don't know if 40 is the minimum age at which we say you should be issuing rulings, or is it just at 40 you're in trouble if you don't issue rulings, but you really could be eligible earlier. The fact that they bring the story regarding Rava tells us that this is actually about that the 40 is about both. You shouldn't do it before you're 40, and once you're 40, you shouldn't resist. But he omits the story with Rava because he doesn't think so. He thinks you can issue rulings before the age of 40. The only restriction he has is that you shouldn't wait after 40. So by implication, just because he omitted the story of Rava, he tells us, yeah, you can rule on Jewish law without being 40 years old. I saw two questions in the chat about the fact that the word she is used. In the book of Mishlei, in the book of Proverbs, the feminine is used to describe Torah. First of all, the word Torah itself is a feminine word. But in general, wisdom, both good wisdom of Torah and dangerous wisdom as well, are both identified as feminine. That's a basic theme in the book of Proverbs. So, I don't know how clear that passage was that I gave as the illustration, but what I wanted to show you is that he brings explicitly the rule regarding blowing shofar on Shabbos in order to say this is the law, and he omits the restriction of the age of 40 as the starting point for issuing legal rulings in order to try to teach you what Jewish law is. Now, a lot of his rulings are landmark practical rulings in particular cases, and some of them are landmark in terms of establishing overall how Jewish law works. I'll give you an example. The Babylonian Talmud, I told you, was canonized after the Jerusalem Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud is earlier. On many issues, the two Talmuds agree. But there are cases where there is disagreement. What do you do if the Jerusalem Talmud says X and the Babylonian Talmud says Y? Rabbi Alfasi answers your question in source number 9. He says, in a case where the Jerusalem Talmud, also known as the Western Talmud, says something different, we don't follow this. Since the passage in our Talmud permits, meaning the Babylonian one, we are not concerned that the Western Talmud prohibits. We rely on our Talmud, which was later. Its sages were more expert in the Western Talmud than we are. And if they didn't know that this passage in the Western Talmud was not authoritative, they would not have permitted. Meaning, the rabbis of the Babylonian Talmud saw the Jerusalem Talmud. They were aware of it. They didn't agree with it, and that's why they said what they said. And since they knew what the Jerusalem Talmud said and disagreed, we're going to follow them. So that's an example of him weighing in on a major, major debate. Clear? Follow? Okay. His work in this halachot that he wrote, this book, was controversial. Not everybody agreed with him for doing this. You know, you break new ground. Some people don't like it when you break new ground. So when he left Fez, and he went to the city that shall not be named in Spain, Rav Alfasi encountered bitter opposition from two rabbis. I told you before that a lot of rabbis were named Yitzchak at this point. So one of them is Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Gayat, known in Hebrew as Ritz Geut, and Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Albalia. They opposed him for what he did. If you take a look at source number 10, I brought you from the historian Zev Yavetz. When he came to Lucena, the hearts of Ibn Albalia and Ibn Gayat turned from him. They didn't like him. This was bad in the eyes of Rav Alfasi, to the point where he expressed his harsh spirit verbally and in writing. There was a back and forth here. There was a lot of strife because there was opposition to what he did. And when Rabbi Yitzchak Albalia neared death, and he saw that with his death, his son Baruch, a very bright 17-year-old youth, would be taken from upon his head, he called his son Baruch and told him softly that his spirit was weak and dying. "I am dying," he said, "and now, my son, rise and go to Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi. Tell him that I have forgiven him for all of the harsh things he said of me verbally and in writing. Stand before him and learn Torah from his mouth, for I know he will be generous to you." And after the youth returned from burying his father, he went to Rav Alfas and told him all that his father had said. And the elderly rabbi wept powerfully, and he spoke to the heart of the youth good and comforting words, and he told him, "Since your father has died, I will be a father to you." And Rav Alfas took him to his home and loved him greatly and taught him the entire Talmud and made him a leader in Israel. So the rivalry ends with the death of one of them, and Rav Alfas saying, "I'm going to take in his son." But there was a lot that went before that, obviously, in which he was opposed. And that didn't stop with him. Maimonides encountered opposition for his codification of Jewish law and the way that he did it. The Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, had those who opposed it as well. Nonetheless, for centuries and centuries, the Sefer Halachot, the book called Halachot, more commonly just called the Rif, which is the acronym for Rabbi Yitzchak and Fez, Rif, or Riaf, as it was called in the early years, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. That work has been published in the back of a standard volume of the Talmud, and here I'm going to share screen with you so I can show you what it looks like, because there's something fascinating about it. First, if you see what should be showing up on your screen, hopefully not jumping. You see it? That's a standard page of Talmud. Okay, that's a normal page of Talmud. Now I'm going to show you, instead, what a page of Rabbi Alfas looks like. Oh, hang on. I have to go back to share that one. I see what I did. This is a page of Rabbi Alfas in the classic form. You can see that it's modeled on the structure of a page of the Talmud. I'm going back to the Talmud here. The Talmud has in the middle, that's the part that I'm highlighting, that's the Talmud. And then commentaries on the outside. Rashi's commentary here, in this volume it's the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, who's on the outside, and you have other commentaries around the page. Here, you have the Rif, Rabbi Alfasi in the middle, and then commentaries on the outside. You follow? So, it's done in a style that's meant to emulate the classic Talmudic style, and it's published in the back of a standard volume of the Talmud because of its status. It causes confusion sometimes for students who open up to Rabbi Alfasi by accident and they can't understand why they're not seeing what everybody else is seeing, because everybody else is in the Talmud and they're on the wrong page. But that's the way it goes. there's a lot more to be said about what the RIF did, but I don't want to, what Rabbi Alfasi did, but I don't want to get too technical. I'm a little worried about that. So I'm adding here that he became a resource for questions from near and far. He was an independent thinker. He decided answers to questions without necessarily consulting others. And we have hundreds of responsa of his, many of them originally in Arabic and then translated. But there were many more that are lost that we don't have. He was a resource far and wide. He also wrote a machzor, by the way, for Yom Kippur, which is interesting. So why do I call him an icon? Like, he's a sage. He did something very important in his halachic work, that's for sure. But I found years ago an observation that I thought really captured it very, very well. Unfortunately, I can't find the source for it anymore. So I didn't bring it on your sheet, but I'm going to tell it to you. There were three problems facing students of Judaism in that era, in that period of time, in the 11th century. One, understanding how to read the Talmud, just how to understand the passages. Number two, understanding the words in the Talmud. And number three, understanding and determining Jewish law. That's what students needed in the day. They needed to know how to read the passage in the Talmud, they needed to know how to translate the words in the Talmud, and they needed to know what the law was. Three sages came along and took care of that. Understanding the passage in the Talmud was taken care of by Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki in France. Understanding the words in the Talmud was taken care of by a rabbi named Rabbi Natan, author of the Aruch, who lived in Rome in this period. And understanding the law, Rabbi Alfasi took care of. So he's really a great leader at that point. And indirectly he led because, as I mentioned to you before, he becomes the mentor of those who would teach the Rambam Maimonides. Maimonides normally follows the views of Rabbi Alfasi. And I want to show you some of the accolades that he received. It's 1057. We're not going to see all of them today. But take a look at source number 11. Maimonides wrote his commentary to the Mishnah when he was very young. And he wrote an introduction, which is still a landmark text, in source number 11. He says, he's describing the history of Jewish law. And he said, the Gaonim, the heads of those yeshivot, composed many commentaries. But to the best of our knowledge, none completed a commentary to the entire Talmud. The Gaonim didn't do it. Some were prevented by brevity of life. Some by the needs of people with their litigation. They had too many issues that they had to be responsible for. Some composed legal works in Arabic or Hebrew, and he gives you some examples. The halachot composed by our great master, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, that's Rabbi Alfasi, of blessed memory, sufficed in place of all of those, because they included all of the benefits of rulings and laws needed for our day, meaning this time of exile, and he already sifted from there all of the errors which had fallen into the rulings of his predecessors. We only have difficulty with a few of his rulings, not even 10 by any measure. He says, this is it. What Rabbi Alfasi did was greater than what anybody before him did. Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai. Take a look at source number 12. I believe he was actually born in Morocco. He makes the comment that Rabbi Alfasi wrote with Ruach HaKodesh. He wrote with divine inspiration. And he gives you a story. He says, in the middle of number 12, I have seen notes from Rabbeinu Yaakov of Marvej, who would ask questions of heaven regarding laws of which he was uncertain, and they would answer him. How do you like that? Once he asked about a law, as to whether it followed the RIF, Rabbi Alfasi, or those who disagreed with him. And they replied from heaven that the law definitely follows Rabbi Alfasi, for he is greater. And they quoted a verse from the book of Genesis, and Yitzchak planted, and the man became great. He grew increasingly until he was very great. One last accolade for him. Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Code of Jewish Law. When I have to issue a ruling, he says, I look at three pillars of halachic rulings. Rabbi Alfasi, Rambam Maimonides, and the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, at the end of the 13th century. Those are my three. And if it's two versus one among them, I'll follow the majority. But that tells you the standing Rabbi Alfasi had. And there's much, much more. I could give you a lot more, but I wanted to limit myself in terms of the space. There are commentaries upon commentaries on his work, Halachot, reflecting its influence in the centuries following him. So what we've seen, to sum up, is number one, we saw the history of Morocco itself, the Berbers, the various empires, and the Islamic conquest. We saw the fate of the Jews in these lands, and the way that in the period of Rabbi Alfasi, it's kind of up and down. We said that Rabbi Alfasi himself has to flee Tunisia due to persecution. He is supported by the Jewish community in Fez for 43 years until he has to flee to Spain. And he becomes a shaper of Jewish law for centuries and centuries afterwards with his work, Halachot. Got it? Good? All right, so I'll take questions. I'm going to stick around because it's late, so I'm letting everybody go who needs to go. But if anyone has questions or comments, I'll be glad to take them. Next week, we move all the way up to the 17th century. And Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar, a very, very different figure. I'm looking forward. Thank you very much, everyone. Yes, Ricky.